Hello, everyone. This is Bill Vatnahar with another edition of Moments in History. American History Magazine, December 2019, has an article written by Rick Atkinson. Actually, it's an excerpt of his book. His book is called The British Are Coming, The War for America, 1775-1777. So this is part of that book. It's called First Blood. At Lexington and then at Concord, civil unrest became insurrection. It begins, few knew their destination. 2 a.m. had come and gone as they put on speed. A brigade of armed men tiptoeing through Boston in the middle of the night had gone not unnoticed. The town, as the British acknowledged, was a good deal agitated. Joseph Warren may have watched the mustering troops. He lived in a rented house on Hanover Street, barely a mile from the foot of the common, and several companies had made for the boats from his North End neighborhood. Regardless, Warren was soon well informed. 2 weeks earlier, the Provincial Congress had agreed that an enemy force exceeding 500 men leaving town with baggage and artillery ought to be considered a threat to the province and met by an assembled army of observation to act solely on the defensive so that it can be justified. This British force, even without heavy guns, was threatening enough for Dr. Warren. Before the first boats pulled off to Boston Beach, he had summoned 2 couriers to carry the alarm to Samuel Adams and John Hancock, holed up in a Lexington parsonage, and to alert the wider countryside. The first herald was a beefy tanner in a slouched hat. William Dawes, Jr., barely 30 years old, still lived in Ann Street, where he had been raised by Puritan stock so strict that the children were forbidden to look out a window on Sundays. Dawes had overcome such constrictions to become an adept smuggler, a patriot messenger, a militia adjutant, and an intelligence agent. While surveilling British officers, he supposedly sometimes posed as a vegetable peddler, sometimes as a miller, sometimes as a drunk. At Warren's instruction, Dawes would ride through the Boston Neck Gate on a slow jogging horse, then loop northwest through Cambridge, rousing households on the way to Lexington. The second herald had already proved his value as a trusted courier in nearly a dozen rides to New York, Philadelphia, New Hampshire, and twice this month, Lexington and Concord. Various newspapers had often mentioned Paul Revere over the past year because of dispatches he carried hither and yon from Boston. He had, as historian David Hackett Fisher would write, a genius for being at the center of great events. Now 40 years old, with the brown eyes of his French Huguenot forebears, a broad ruddy face, and the sinewy arms of a metal worker, Revere had run his own business as a silver and goldsmith for more than 20 years, making teapots, mending spoons, inventing alloys, and setting false teeth, including 2 for Dr. Warren. He had become a skilled copperplate engraver, who also made plates for playing cards, broadside illustrations, and paper money. For all Revere's legendary bravado, his life was stained with tragedy. He would father 16 children, his little lambs, and most would die before their time. This was his time. After a brief consultation with Warren, he hurried to his nearby house in Clark Square, snatched his riding boots, then picked his way through a twisting North End alleys to the waterfront. 2 Confederates waited with a dinghy. Softly they rowed from the wharf against the young flood and under that old moon, with a temperate breeze stirring out of the southwest. Ahead loomed HMS Somerset, a 70-gun ship of the line anchored as a sentinel in the ferryway between Boston and Charleston, in water so shallow the vessel could barely swing at anchor. Some Somerset crewmen were manning longboats at Lechmere Point or working her pumps. An inspection this week had showed the man of war to be in desperately poor repair. Seams rotting, butt ends open, long overdue for caulking and sheathing in Halifax. Whether distracted or sightless, the watch failed to spot the small boat that scooted past the big craft's stem and onto the Charleston shore. In 1775, America had more than 3,000 churches, representing 18 denominations, but none was more important on this April night than Christ Church on Boston's Salem Street. Known as Old North, the church featured 8 great bells cast in England, a magnificent quartet of hand-carved wooden angels perched above the nave, and a towering steeple, long a landmark for navigators entering the harbor, and featured in a Boston panorama engraved by Revere the previous year. As carefully planned earlier in the week, another Confederate, Revere identified him only as a friend, climbed 154 stairs and a rickety ladder to a window in the steep's north face, lugging 2 lanterns of tinted steel with glass panels and metal rings for hanging or carrying. The flint and steel soon lighted the candles, and twin gleams could be seen across the harbors. As Revere intended, rebel leaders beyond the Charles now knew that Britain troops were on the move via Back Bay, 2 if by sea, rather than taking the more circuitous way, 1 if by land route through Roxbury. Dramatic as the signal was, and as enduring in American iconography, it proved superfluous, since both Dawes and Revere eluded British patrols to spread the word themselves. Handed the reins to a big brown New England mare, Revere swung into the saddle and took off at a canter across Charleston Neck, rider and steed, hooves striking sparks, merging into a single elegant creature, bound for glory. 2 hours later, Revere trotted into Lexington, his mount lathered after outgalloping a pair of British commander, General Thomas Gage's equestrian sentinels near Charleston. Veering north towards the Mystic River to avoid further trouble, Revere had alerted almost every farmstead and minute captain within shouting distance. Popular lore later credited him with a stirring battle cry, "The British are coming," but a witness quoted him as a warning, more prosaically, "The regulars are coming out." Now he carried the alarm to the Reverend Jonas Clark's parsonage, just up the road from Lexington Common. Here Clark had 3,000 sermons in 20 years. Here he had caught up the stairs each morning to rouse his 10 children. And here Clark had given sanctuary, in a bedroom to the left of the front door, to the renegades Hancock and Samuel Adams. A squad of militiamen stood guard at the house as Revere dismounted. 2 warnings had already come from the east. As many as 9 mounted British officers had been seen patrolling Middlesex roads, perhaps upon some evil design. At the door, a suspicious orderly sergeant challenged Revere, and Clark blocked his path until Hancock reportedly called out, "Come in, Revere. We're not afraid of you." The herald delivered his message. British regulars by the hundreds were coming out, first by boat, then on foot. There was not a moment to lose. 30 minutes later, Dawes arrived with the same warning, and the 2 riders soon swung towards Concord. As Adams packed to move deeper into the countryside, Hancock lumbered about the parsonage with his sword and pistol, prattling on about making a desperate stand until he, too, was persuaded to bolt for safety in his fine carriage. The Lexington bell began to clang in the wooden tower hard by the meeting house. More gallopers rode off to rouse half 100 villages. Warning shots echoed from farm to farm. Bonfires flared, drums beat. Across the colony, in an image that would endure for centuries, solemn men grabbed their firelocks and stalked off in search of danger, leaving the plow in the furrow, the hoe in the garden, the hammer on the anvil, the bucket at the wheel sweep. This day would become famous before it dawned. Lexington spread across 10,000 acres occupied by 750 people and 400 cows. Two cleared acres had been given over to the town common, where the 11-mile road from Charleston approached straight and level for the final 500 yards, then forked at the three-story meeting house, big and homely as a barn, before continuing the 6 miles to Concord. On these 2 acres, some 130 militiamen, summoned by that incessant pealing, milled, stamping their feet against the nighttime chill. They awaited orders from their captain, John Parker, described as a great tall man with a high, wide brow. A farmer, father of 7, and sometimes town assessor, Parker, age 45, had fought as a sergeant in the French and Indian War at Louisbourg in Quebec. Shadows falling across the common deepened the dark sockets around Parker's eyes, symptomatic of the pulmonary tuberculosis that would kill him that September. Massachusetts Bay had been the first colony to form its militia into regiments, one per county in 1636, in an effort to fashion a military organization suitable for more than haphazard local defense. Each generation since had gone to war at least once. An estimated 1 able-bodied Massachusetts man in 4 had served in the last French war. Some militia units were little more than armed rabble, saluting unsuspecting officers by firing blank cartridges at their feet or sneaking up on young women before shooting into the air in a weird courtship ritual. Lexington's troops, ranging in age from 16 to 66, were more disciplined, under militia rules. Any man interrupting the clerk when he called the roll was fined 2 shillings. The town had no minute company, but had voted money for drums, a carriage to bury the dead, and gunpowder, which was now stored in the meeting house. A scout dispatched in search of redcoats returned around 3 a.m. to advise Parker that none could be found. Perhaps this was another false alarm, or a British feint. Rather than keep his men out in the cold to no purpose, the captain dismissed the company with orders to reassemble at the sound of a drum. Some men ambled home. Most headed to the red-doored Buckman Tavern, an ancient public house of entertainment. Here they could find a crackling fire and a mug of warm flip, heated at the hearth with a hot iron. Parker's scout had not ventured far enough east. The British were coming on hard, spurred by a distant pop of warning shots and the gleam of alarm fires flaring on the horizon. Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith, the expedition commander, had heeded Gage's order to lunge for the Concord River bridges with a party of the best marchers. 6 light infantry companies now hurried ahead of the main column. Assured by a passing teamster that 1,000 rebels were in arms, Smith also sent a courier to Boston to plead for reinforcements, a wise impulse. The vanguard making for Concord was led by John Pitcairn. Not only was Major Pitcairn a Marine, on horseback and far from the sea to which he was accustomed, he was commanding more than 200 men from a half-dozen army regiments to whom he was a stranger. As an apricot glow began to brighten the eastern sky soon after 4 a.m., the sounds of a country folk alarmed intensified. Bells, shots, distant hoofbeats. Pitcairn ordered his troops to halt and load their weapons. With practiced motions, each soldier plucked a paper cartridge from his waist pouch, bit open an end, dribbled some powder grains into the musket flash pan, then poured the rest, close to 1/2 ounce, down the muzzle, followed by the bullet and the cartridge wadding, which he tamped home with a steel ramrod. Imperfect barrels, imperfect balls, a lack of sights, variable powder, and windage between ball and barrel meant the musket was marginally accurate at 50 yards, hopeless beyond 100 yards. But that hardly mattered when bullets were fired in swarms at close range. The enormous lead slug, nearly 3/4 of an inch in diameter and an ounce in heft could stop a charging bull. At Pitcairn's command, the men seated their ramrods and surged forward, breathing hard, pulses pounding. The 14-inch bayonets on their muskets protruded above their heads like a picket fence. Scraps of cartridge paper spat out, littered the road behind them. The British were less than 2 miles from Lexington when another scout brought word to Parker of their approach. A drum beat to arms, and the infernal bell tolled again. Men in Buckman Tavern sent their tankards next to their guttering candles and scrambled to the common. Other men, filling their power horns in an upper gallery of the meeting house that served as a village armory, clattered down the steps and out the door. But only half the company answered this second call. Fewer than 80 men in 2 ranks, anxiously peering east for redcoats. "Don't molest them," Parker said, "without they being first." Precisely why he chose to confront a superior force from the exposed expanse of the village lawn, rather than from a nearby thicket or stone wall, would never be clear. Perhaps dying himself, Parker had lost all impulse to seek shelter. Certainly he seemed fixed on something larger than his life. When an anxious militiaman said, "There are so few of us, it is folly to stand here," the captain replied, "The first man who offers to run shall be shot down." Full dawn brought the loomy smell of plowed fields and another mild, pleasant morning. The British vanguard swung into view. The tramp of heavy brogans broke the quiet as 3 companies veered to the right of the meeting house at double quick time. Pitcairn, on his horse, led the rest of the column to the left, following the curve of the Concord Road before cantering onto the common. A guttural roar began to build in the ranks, more growl than cheer. "Soldiers, don't fire," Pitcairn yelled, according to a British lieutenant. "Keep your ranks, form and surround them." Spectators, gawking from the road, heard other officers yell, "Throw down your arms, ye villains, ye rebels, and disperse, ye rebels, immediately." When regulars closed to within 50 yards, Parker apparently took the command to heart. As he swore in a deposition a week later, "Upon their sudden approach, I immediately ordered our militia to disperse and not to fire." A single gunshot sounded above the clamor, possibly a warning shot or a sniper at Buckman Tavern. Whether fired first on the common, whoever fired first on the common would remain forever uncertain, but muskets quickly barked along the British line, promiscuous shooting from agitated soldiers in a makeshift command led by a stranger. Without any order or regularity, as Pitcairn later acknowledged, the light infantry began a scattered fire, contrary to the repeated orders both of me and the officers that were present. Brilliant yellow flame erupted from each muzzle, along with a fat, flat boom, a belch of smoke, and that heavy lead slug moving at 1,000 feet per second. Those who outlived that day would remember the acrid smell of burning powder, the rattle of ramrods shoving home another volley, the whiz of balls that missed, and the terrible thud of balls hitting home, the shouts, the screams, the puff of dust from bullets smacking a wall, as if stone were breathing. Billowing smoke grew so dense that soon only the upper torsos of officers on horseback could be seen clearly. One lieutenant from the 38th Foot lost control of his spooked mount, which bolted 600 yards through the village until the rider finally reined in. Few of Parker's men managed to fire more than once, if that. Nothing was right except the courage. Militiaman John Monroe grazed across the cheek with a scorch mark on his jacket where another bullet had passed between his arm and his waist. Fired, retreated a short distance, then loaded his musket with a double charge, which blew off a foot of the barrel. Jonas Parker, a cousin of the captain, nearly placed his bullets and spare flints in a hat at his feet. A British ball knocked him to his knees, and as he fumbled to reload, British bayonets tore him dead. Pitcairn slashed at the air with his sword as a futile signal to cease fire. Our men, without any orders, rushed in upon them, Lieutenant Barker of the King's Own told his diary. The men were so wild that they could hear no orders. Only when Colonel Smith cantered into the village with his grenadier companies and ordered a drummer to beat to arms did the carnage end. I was desirous, Smith later wrote, of putting a stop to all further slaughter of those deluded people. After a final sputter of gunfire, gray smoke drifted off, revealing dying lumps on the green grass, blood and so much more leaking away. Lexington had not been a battle, or even a skirmish, but an execution. The only British casualties were two privates, lightly wounded by gunshot, and Pitcairn's horse, nicked twice in the flank. The American tally was far worse. Eight rebels were dead, nine wounded. Of those slain, only two bodies lay in the original American line. Some have taken bullets in the back while dispersing, including one man captured earlier in the morning and killed while ostensibly trying to escape 100 yards to the east. Jonathan Harrington was shot close to his house on the western tip of the common and reportedly died on his doorstep, within view of his wife and son. Samuel Adams, upon hearing of the gunplay, exclaimed, "Oh, what a glorious morning is this!" But Adams had not been there to see the divine clay smeared on Lexington Green, along with the litter of hundreds of Tom Paper cartridges. Reverend Clark was there, watching from several 100 yards distance, as Smith, who had prevented his men from pillaging the nearby houses, agreed to allow a celebratory salute. "The redcoats drew up and formed in a body on the common," Clark reported, "fired a volley and gave three hoorays by way of triumph. Then, forming again by companies, they turned and marched west, towards Concord." Concord was ready for them. A British mounted patrol had captured Paul Revere at a bend in the road near Folly Pond, but William Dawes managed to escape at a gallop. Continuing his charmed morning, Revere, saucy and unrepentant, even with a pistol clapped to his head, was soon released, though without his brown mare, to make his way on foot to Clark Parsonage. But others had carried warnings into Concord, where a sentinel at the firehouse, at the courthouse, fired his musket and heaved on the bell rope. Reports of shooting Lexington spread like electric fire by one account, though some insisted the British would load only powder cartridges without bullets. Militiamen, alone or in clusters or entire companies with fife and drum, rambled toward Concord, carrying pine torches and bullet pouches, their pockets stuffed with rye bread and cheese. They toted muskets, of course, some dating to the French War or earlier, but also ancient fowling pieces, rapiers, sabers harmed from farm tools and powder and cow horns. Sometime before 8 a.m., perhaps 200 militiamen headed to Lexington to the rap of drums and the trill of fifes. 20 minutes later, and barely a quarter mile away, 800 British soldiers came into view, like a scarlet dragon on the road near the junction known as Miriam's Corner. The sun shined on their arms, and they made a noble appearance in their red coats. Without orders, a British soldier fired into the river. The white splash rose as if thrown from a thrown stone. More shots followed, a splatter of musketry that built into a ragged volley. Much of the British fire flew high, common among nervous or ill-trained troops, but not all shots. Captain Davis of Acton pitched over dead. Blood from a gaping chest wound splattered the men next to him. Private Abner Hosmer also fell dead, killed by a ball that hit below his left eye and blew through the back of his neck. Three others were wounded, including a young fifer and Private Josiah Brooks of Lincoln, gazed in the forehead so cleanly that another private concluded that the British, improbably, were firing jackknives. Others knew better. Captain David Brown, who lived with his wife Abigail and 10 children 200 yards uphill from the bridge, shouted, "God damn them, they are firing balls. Fire, men, fire." The cry became an echo, sweeping the ranks. "Fire, for God's sake, fire." The crash of muskets rose to a roar. A general popping from them ensued, Captain Lorre later told General Gage. One of Lorre's lieutenants had reloaded with a bullet slammed into his chest, spinning him around. Three other lieutenants were wounded in quick succession, making casualties of half the British officers at the bridge and ending Lorre's fragile control over his detachment. Redcoats began leaking to the rear, and soon all three companies broke towards Concord, abandoning some of the wounded. "We were obliged to give away," and an ensign acknowledged, "then run with the greatest precipitous." Amos Barrett reported that the British were running and hobbling about, looking back to see if we were after them. Battle smoke draped the river. 3 minutes of gunplay had cost five American casualties, including two dead. Of the British, eight were wounded and two killed, but another badly hurt soldier, trying to regain his feet, was mortally insulted by Minutemen Amy White, who crushed his skull with a hatchet. A peculiar quiet descended over the poet James Ruffell Lorre, who would call that extra parting bridge across which old world passed into the new. Some militiamen began to pursue the fleeting British into Concord, but then veered from the road to shelter behind a stone wall. Colonel Smith had started toward the river with grenadier reinforcements, then thought better of it and trooped back into Concord. The four companies previously sent with Captain Parsons to Barrett's farm now trotted unhindered across the bridge, only to find their dying comrade mutilated by White's axe, his brains uncapped. The atrocity grew into the retelling. Soon, enraged British soldiers claimed that he and others had been scalped, their noses and ears sliced off, their eyes gouged out. As Noah Parkhurst from Lincoln observed moments after the shooting stopped, "Now the war has begun, and no one knows when it'll end." And that's the end of the article, which was an excerpt from Rich Atkinson, who has a book out called The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775-1777. So that was an excerpt from his book, and that was in the American History Magazine, December 2019. And that's all we have for today. We appreciate you listening. And until next time, this is Bill Vondahar with another edition of Moments in History. Thank you.